Hello and welcome to August's interview edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. I'm Fiona Taylor, and in a moment I'll be joined by agroecology writer Nancy Matsumoto as she discusses her book, Reaping What She Sows. Nancy has brought together stories of the women who are rebuilding our broken food systems. From the maverick farmers, millers and bakers bringing back local grain economies, the brewers, distillers and winemakers who are regenerating land and ecosystems, and also the indigenous and diasporic seed savers, passing on important seed for future generations. I first asked Nancy what her inspiration was for writing the book. Shall we start first just talking about the whole book? Like, what led you to really thinking that this needed to be written?
Yeah, it's really kind of about the approach that I took, because I have been writing about organic agriculture, agroecology, and food sovereignty for many years now. And a lot of times it felt like writing or preaching to the converted, people who already believe in these systems and understand them. For other people, the general population, I think there's a certain attraction of terms like farm to table or sustainable. They go to restaurants and they see these terms and they kind of feel that it's a good thing, it's virtuous. But I think what was lacking was a real systemic understanding of how hard it is to create a whole supply chain that is regenerative and organic from the production of the product all the way through the consumer, either buying it at a store or going to a farmer's market. And so many times when I was doing these stories about farmers, ranchers, people working the sea, the barriers were really about the supply chain. It was about, I am a small organic farmer, but I can't find the equipment I need because the industrialization of agriculture has completely put these small businesses, small people out of business. So there are no small combines. There are no small threshers. All of this equipment that used to be part of the fabric of every region, every locality, was very hard to find. So that was one thing. Or say you're a grass-fed, grass-finished beef producer, but you don't have appropriately sized processing facilities. So there were just these structural barriers to people really creating the supply chain that they needed. And so I decided I want to do a book about supply chains, about how we create something that can mimic what big food and big agriculture is doing. In other words, completely vertically integrated, but on a very equitable and regenerative and organic basis. And this is a very hard thing to do because we don't have any of that government support, the subsidies, the crop loans, our whole agricultural system, and I believe it's probably somewhat like this in the UK, is geared towards supporting conventional. And so, you know, it's kind of about how do you level the playing field? And yeah, so that's why I wanted to write this book. And I wanted to forefront women because I feel that they are driving change in this area.
Well, that's a point I really wanted to understand, because you say somewhere in the book that you weren't trying to write a kind of women's rights book. You wanted to showcase and platform the change that women are already bringing about. So what is it most that you noticed about the approach that women are taking in this field?
I think it's less of a top-down, profit-driven motive, and it's thinking about community. It's thinking about relationships. It's thinking about building systems. I think women are very good systems thinkers because we're always juggling so many things, including caring for our family, caring for the community, caring for animals and nature. And women are less beholden to the status quo. They are less often in the ownership, the landowning positions that maybe would have a lot of incentive to hang on to the existing system. And I have a wonderful quote in the book from a longtime vegetable distributor, Boo Nigrins. And she says, when women control the finances, No one goes hungry. Everyone gets a fair shake. It's about cooperation, not about competition. And I think that sort of sums up why there's so many women doing this work. Not to say there aren't many, many men, but I just think that so many times I've been in a room and it's all women. It's mostly women. When I go to speak at food and nutrition programs in universities, often it's almost all women, maybe a few men in the room. So I feel like there's just a real interest among women in this movement.
Yeah. Okay. And of all the women you met, is there one that really stood out?
Oh, there's so many who I admire so much for their passion and their drive. I think about, you know, we talked about the seeds and people who are making it their life's work to preserve seeds, to save seeds. There's a woman in Vancouver, British Columbia, who started the equivalent of a farm CSA, but with fish, so seafood, direct from small producers, created a whole supply chain. So she's in British Columbia. I'm on the other side of the country in Toronto. I can buy shares, support these small fishermen, and know their stories when I get their fish, who they are, when they caught it, why we're eating this because it's in season now. All these things that you expect on a land-based product she's doing with ocean products.
Oh, how interesting. And a lot of that is about the labeling and the communication that goes alongside.
I think so. It's about storytelling. It's about building community. It's about getting the average consumer to feel like they know this group of producers. They want to support them. They know what the obstacles are when you're talking about an industry that is very industrialized. You have large corporations, a lot of private equity now owning fishing fleets. It's this faceless monolith versus small family fisher people. And I think that narrative is very powerful and it's important.
The whole book is called Reaping What She Sows. For us here at Garden Organic and the Heritage Seed Library, that instantly brings seeds to mind, you know, that she has sown seeds and she's now reaping those harvest from those seeds. So you have devoted a whole chapter around seeds, and the chapter is called Sowing the Seeds of the Alt Food System Future, Visits with Indigenous and Diasporic Women. That is a very, very interesting place to start. We have seeds in our collection at the Heritage Seed Library that we know were brought from one country to another country in somebody's pocket and then handed down. We know that that tradition exists, but you've really gone into that in this chapter. I think that's completely fascinating. For somebody who's never thought about that, can you set out what that really means? Because for most people, getting hold of seed is simply a case of just going to a store and buying some seed. And actually, there is so much more to it than that. And seed is such a vital natural resource, possibly the most vital natural resource of our time. And people don't always have to buy it.
Yes, I agree. You know, the fact that there are these tiny little packets of DNA that can travel across oceans and continents and retain that integrity and grow out. And for these diasporic women, it's a connection back to an ancestral culture that sometimes they didn't even grow up with. I tell the story of a wonderful seed saver named Kristen Leach, who is a Korean adoptee. So she grew up on Long Island in New York in an Anglo-white family, never really knowing what a Korean vegetable tasted like until she moved to the West Coast, got interested in farming, got her hands on an Asian seed catalog, and discovered this whole world. And it really spoke to her on a very deep, visceral level. And she talked about this ancestral longing for connection that was just deep within her. She's now a very important instructor and seed saver. And so I wanted to focus on that diasporic aspect. It's very interesting, the difference between America, where we have an indigenous community that were the original stewards of seeds for millennia. And then often those seeds were taken by white settlers and renamed. So on the one hand, you have this indigenous story. On the other, you have this immigrant diasporic story. So I wanted to combine the two. UK is so interesting because of the whole story of empire and this wonderful tradition of gardening and cultivating plants and really love for horticulture. But then, you know, you have that realization that so many of these were part of the plunder of other countries. And how do we untangle all of that? So our stories are a little bit different. But I wanted to talk about wresting back control and set it against the backdrop of the sort of patenting and the locking up of seed and genetic material by big agrochemical companies like Bayer and Monsanto, where farmers every year have to buy new seeds because these will not grow out true to type. They're genetically modified, they're hybrids. What the seed savers in my chapter are doing is growing seeds that are open source. People can buy them, save them year to year, save the best ones, the most climate adaptive ones. You know, it's a living, evolving thing, and yet a real connection to the past. And so it's very meaningful to these people. I wanted to end on this very hopeful chapter of we can take control. And I think backyard gardening is, you know, where it all starts, where you can preserve this and enjoy it. And it's really just the seed and your own love and nurturing that's keeping these cultures and traditions alive.
The reason for that is because seeds are getting lost, isn't it? The reason for needing to save seed is because, you know, seed has become concentrated into the hands of a very small number of companies, as you mentioned, and because it has been patented and therefore taken out of kind of community control. But what you're talking about is something that just operates perfectly naturally alongside of that system. Can you give some examples of how successful the community movement has been?
Yes. Well, I talked to so many different seed savers, and in the indigenous community, it was very moving because you have several generations that were separated from their culture by basically missionaries who put them in schools, made them cut their hair, forbade them from speaking their native language, completely cut them off from their customs. So I start by talking about how there's a lot of shame in the community about these are the seeds of our heritage, and yet we don't know that much about them. And so people in the indigenous community are now starting a lot of educational workshops and seed exchange events, seed saving. And there was this one very touching YouTube video that was very gentle, and it said, you know, don't worry, we have been disconnected from our culture, and we're here to relearn these traditions and these foods. So in many cases, it's kind of really starting from a very basic level and learning as a community. And I saw this going on. Rebecca Webster, one of the indigenous leaders I spoke to, talked about a wonderful squash, Haudenosaunee squash that is plentiful and delicious. And it's called, I think, Buffalo Creek. But it had been renamed by white settlers as Boston Marrow. And so you will often see it in the seed catalogs as Boston Marrow. And so there are this whole term of rematriating seeds. Again, it's a matriarchal society, a woman leadership, but it's bringing back these seeds into the communities where they first started. And Becky Webster said, you know, we can't put a fence around our seeds. You know, people are going to take them and we're not going to prevent that, but we want to reclaim the names and really put them back into our culture where they belong. And I visited a number of different seed savers, saw beautiful squash like this big, these Gete squash, unusual corn varieties, such richness of biodiversity that these seed savers are trying to bring back. It's very exciting. And it was a really fun chapter to report.
Can I ask you a little bit about the jalapeno gate part of your chapter?
Yes, this was an incident that really underscored how opaque and not transparent our big seed system has become. As we mentioned, seeds are now controlled by a handful of companies that control well over half of all seed trade, and it's global. And so you have these, you don't really know where the seeds are coming from, where they're being propagated. There are giant companies that then get them from overseas. So one summer, people thought they were growing out a certain kind of pepper, and there were all kinds of different peppers coming out. So I think it was supposed to be jalapeno, but there were many different, people didn't know the surprise thing that was going to come up out of their garden. And they went back to the nursery or the store where they bought the plants, and it was very hard for those owners to then trace back, well, where did these really originate from? And it was an eye-opener. It was people realizing we're not in control of our seeds the way we were. There used to be hundreds of thousands of small farmers, backyard growers who saved seeds, traded seeds, shared seeds. You'd have a really local culture where these are seeds from your area or your community. And now it has become global, faceless. Again, the genetic material is patented, so no one person owns it. It's owned by corporations. So it was just kind of a real stark illustration of where seeds are today and what's happened to the industry.
Yes, indeed. Do you garden yourself, Nancy?
I love gardening. And as a child, I had my own strawberry patch. I grew up in Southern California. I took care of a dahlia bed and these little cute succulent plants we had called portulacas. And I remember saving the seeds and collecting them. As an adult, my life has been so nomadic and very urban. I have a very robust apartment garden of succulents, and we have a Norwegian pine and some big plants, but it's right now, I'm sad to say, apartment gardening. And I've tried doing herbs and things like that, but I really long for a community garden to be part of. And so I love when I'm out in the field reporting and I'm with farms or with seed savers, and it's very fulfilling. I wish I could have more of it in my own personal life.
It seems like you went all over the place to do this book. You talked a little bit about Indigenous peoples earlier. Can you give us an idea of the geography?
Yes, it's six countries overall. One in Asia was sort of by chance because I happened to be there on vacation. A friend of mine in Bangkok took me on a sustainable Bangkok tour, and he introduced me to a wonderful woman who is a fisheries conservationist, but had really wanted to help her community. What happened in Thailand is the same thing that I talked about in Vancouver, where you're living in a place surrounded by beautiful fisheries and oceans, and yet you cannot get locally caught fish because it's all industrialized. In the case of Canada, it's sent back to China, processed and then brought back. So Thailand was kind of a little outlier. North America, I live in Toronto, grew up as an American in the United States, so much of it is North America focused. But I wanted to include a chapter on coffee and chocolate, just because for so many of us, we need to have these in our daily life. They're not grown where we live. And so I wanted to know, how can we support small farmers and what is the most ethical way? So I went to Belize to visit cacao growers. I went to Guatemala to visit people who are picking coffee in the highlands and trace this very direct supply chain from Central America to Florida. And then I went to Puebla, Mexico, because I have a chapter on regenerative beverages. And I found two women who are making completely regenerative mezcal. Agave production is something that's very extractive and destructive now. So I wanted to show the alternative. So that's kind of the geography of the book. I would have loved to make it more international, but I'm afraid I had to finance my travel and that would have been just out of the question.
It's interesting to hear the perspectives from those different areas because we have a bit of a different tradition in the UK, and we look over the Atlantic to the States. And certainly when I'm talking amongst my kind of seed fraternity, if you like, we sort of envy the situation in the States where there are no marketing laws that prohibit the community distribution of seed. People can sell seed that they have themselves created and produced. We're not allowed to do that here. So if people produce seed and they want to sell it, it has to be on the commercial list, which is part of the government legislation. So you cannot produce your own fantastic beetroot, you know, and test it out and all that stuff and then sell it. You can produce your own fantastic beetroot and trade that seed with somebody else who can give you seed for their fantastic squash or whatever it is. So you can do that. So lots of that happens at community level, but you cannot sell it. And so then it starts to automatically then prohibit innovation, and certainly in that small producer place. And so I've always assumed, perhaps wrongly, that there was more opportunity for small scale innovation in the States than perhaps there is here in the seed world.
That's fascinating. And I did not know that about the way things work in Britain. I do think that stifles innovation and it kind of creates more of an underground economy and trading. I'm afraid I can't really speak that knowledgeably to the way it works here. I do know that there are places like Kitazawa, which has been sold. I recently saw a wonderful Japanese seed catalog, what Second Generation Seed is doing, Kristen Leach. They are selling their seeds. Kula Nursery, a wonderful woman in the San Francisco Bay Area who is growing out seeds and selling them. Connecting to her South Asian heritage, India and Pakistan. So that there is seed like that being developed on a small scale and being sold. So I can tell you that it is happening. And but, you know, there aren't a lot of people doing it. It's quite a niche market still. And but at least it does happen here.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of the rise of regenerative and organic practice, I just wonder about the place of women in raising up the organic and regenerative sector.
It is. I'm immersed in that world. And so I meet amazing people all the time who are working in regenerative and organic. I just went to a huge conference in Monterey, California called EcoFarm, something like 1,000 people who are big believers in ecological farming. However, when you look at the numbers, we're still talking about only maybe 2-3% of all the production of produce in North America. So it is a drop in the bucket. I do feel like the current federal administration in the United States has really struck a big blow against regenerative because there was a lot happening under the previous federal administration where money was going into climate smart agriculture and soil science and regenerative practices. We're kind of having to start that all over. On the other hand, I do feel that there is a tipping point and more people are understanding how destructive our conventional food system is. And a lot of it is driven by climate change and understanding how much agriculture is driving destructive climate worsening through air, through soil, through water. So I think there's a huge amount of work that still needs to be done. that was really the purpose of my book, is to move the needle a little bit more and to identify avenues through which we can make a little bit more large scale change, institutional procurement of organic and regenerative, as opposed to small scale farmers markets, for example, can move the needle a little bit more quickly. So we need to focus on things like that. And often it comes down to legislative and policy changes too, which are very important.
The strapline of this book is how women are rebuilding our broken food system. The food system is broken, but it's powerful, right? So the reason it's powerful is because you talked about the supply chains actually being vertical all the way through it. How can we integrate organic into that vertical supply chain in a more meaningful way?
Yes, I know people have taken issue with the term broken. Maybe more destructive might be a better term, because it is very powerful, because it is extremely efficient and completely vertically integrated. And that's how corporations are able to wring out every last cent of profit, because they're spending so little on everything else, including regenerating the earth. So I advocate for really, it's hard to say, you know, organic is going to fit into this seamless, large scale and very long and opaque system. I advocate for sort of an alternative food system that takes cues from that efficiency, the vertical integration, but is doing it on a much more local and regional scale, so that we have more food security in communities and region. We're not relying so much on very long international. We're seeing what's happening with wars, with climate change. Those supply chains are really not reliable, and we need to build resilience in our community. So I'm saying, yes, let's take a cue from that efficiency, but also figure in planet and people at the same time, and making a three-legged stool instead of the one-legged that is completely profit-driven, because that's what's gotten us into the big mess that we're in now. So the more that we can grow and strengthen these local and regional supply chains and shift people's behavior by raising their consciousness to even realize that they have a choice. You know, it's sort of like the ocean we swim in, the industrial food system. We don't think about it. We don't think about what it means, who it is enriching, how it is depleting our ecosystems. But once we have that consciousness, then we can consciously say, no, I want to go to these alternative supply systems and strengthen them. And the more people that do that, the more readily available, the more affordable, all the things that we want to see happen, happens at a certain level of scale. But I want it to be a local and regional scale.
That's where sustainability lies, isn't it?
Yes.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It was just really good to talk to you.
Thank you. It was delightful.
Thanks so much for listening to this month's edition of the Organic Gardening Podcast. If you've enjoyed listening, please recommend us to a friend or leave us a review on your preferred podcast app. If you have a question for the podcast or you'd like to send us some feedback, do get in touch via email. That's podcast@gardenorganic.org.uk, or you can message us on Facebook or Instagram. We're at Garden Organic UK. Join us in September when Chris and I will be catching up in the potting shed, and Anton will be joining us to answer your questions. All that's left for me to do now is to thank Kevin McLeod for the music, and we'll see you next time.